Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Strubble, Iowa, and is a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. He earned a master's degree in public policy from Columbia University and a law degree from the University of Denver. For 30 years, he served in the U.S. Army, retiring with the rank of colonel. From 2001 through 2005, he served as United States Ambassador to the Holy See, the Vatican, and from 2005 to 2007, he was Secretary of Veterans Affairs. His name? Ambassador James Nicholson. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Hello.
Ambassador?
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Jack Rasula. It's an honor to have you on the show.
It's my honor, Jack. Thank you.
Can you pick up the phone by chance?
I can. Hold on a second, Jack. Yeah, how's that?
That's much better. Jim, this will actually, their show will air on Sunday, May 15th, okay? So a couple weeks from now. So, all right, we have a 7-minute segment, a 10-minute, 10-minute, 9.5. We throw the commercials in later. We're encouraged to talk about our faith. And WJR on Sunday nights can be heard in 27 states and half of Canada. So,
is that a private sponsored public radio station?
No. It's the Voice of the Great Lakes. It's one of the 10 largest stations in America, owned by Cumulus. But the general managers, et cetera, like the fact that we got some faith based people. So, okay.
Okay. Yes, sir.
All right. And our producer's Mark Blackwell. Ready, Mark?
Yes.
I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the Honorable James Nicholson, former ambassador to the Holy See, the Vatican. Ambassador, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Well, it's my honor. Thank you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood growing up in the little town in Iowa, please?
Well, before we got into the little town, we lived out on a farm because after World War II ended, my father had been an enlisted man in the Navy, and he came home, and by then we had six kids, but we had no place to live. We were literally homeless, and a very kind farmer who'd had a home that his hired man had lived in before he got a lot of machinery said we could live in that house free, but of course the house had no windows, no electricity, no plumbing. But we moved into it because we had no alternative and got some windows put in. And we lived there for several years. Unfortunately, my father relapsed into his chronic disease of alcoholism, and he was frequently gone and did not provide much income for us. So we were not only abandoned out there, but we were often very hungry. So it was... it was a very difficult time, and my older brother went off. He was living with my grandmother, but my mother was trying hard to keep us together and to keep our spirits up. And she used to read to us around a kerosene lantern there. She'd read the Bible, and we would pray together, and she would say to us, "This is very difficult. I don't know why we're being put through this, but if we can endure, you kids will have an opportunity because of the country we live in." And what she used to say to us was always, "Pray hard, work hard, and study hard." She had gone to high school. She was a valedictorian of her class. She was a four-year Latin scholar. So she literally used to correct our grammar out there in that deprived condition that we lived in. We went to a one-room school a mile away, and I remember once that I had to wear two shoes that didn't match, and it was very embarrassing and humiliating. The other kids around were, you know, they were kids. They weren't intentionally really being mean, but they were. I mean, it was, and nobody else was real wealthy, but they were industrious, those farm families. And so it was a very difficult time for our family, but somehow we got through it by the grace of God and the power of my mother's leadership and her faith. And then we moved into this little town called Struble, Iowa, and that improved our life quite a bit. I went to a two-room school, and then when my siblings and I got into high school, we went into a nice little Iowa town 8 miles away to high school. And although my father continued, unfortunately, with his alcoholism, he just couldn't whip it. And so after my freshman year of high school, he was they didn't have treatment centers, so he was in the state insane asylum, and we had nothing to eat, and we had a big flood in Iowa, and I got a job on the Great Northern Railroad as a 15-year-old, weighed 120 pounds, out there with a gang replacing the track that had been flooded out, and all of a sudden we had money to buy groceries with, and my father came out of this asylum, and he was sober, and I was able, with the money I had, to buy a car, so he got a job and had a car to drive to this job. And you know, once again, God had come through for us, and that went along pretty well for a while, but again he relapsed. And and so it was a real cauldron that we were raised in. And it was my mother who insisted that we maintain our dignity, said, "You're just as important as any other human being, and if you will just pray and believe that, you know, we can make it through this." And she was right. I mean, we had 8 kids, one died, and all 7 of the kids in our family went to college. 4 of us have postgraduate degrees, and have an older brother who's a retired Army general, and he has a son who's currently a 4-star
yes.
general in the Army. And so it was a real testimonial to faith and persistence, and that has served me very well in my life.
You and your brother Jack both got to West Point. Talk about your West Point career days and duty, honor, country, please, Jim.
West Point was another real transformation. I mean, you can imagine coming from a town of 99 people and going into New York, looking up at those buildings, and then trying to find your way to the bus station to go up the river to West Point, which I did. And then entered, you know, the Corps of Cadets, and began the academic rigors, which were very challenging for me, having come from a small Midwestern high school. But again, prayer, persistence, hard work paid off. That was indelibly engraved in my mind from my mother. And so I graduated, and cadets, you kind of joke about that motto. You hear it so often, the duty, honor, country. But once you get out of there, you realize how real and how substantial that is, and how much that has become emblazoned into your own soul, your own heart, your own personal culture, that you really do believe in the importance of duty and honor in our country. And I would add God as well, because once again at West Point, you can go to daily Mass. I'm a Catholic, and so I, after Reveille, would walk to Mass and pray that I would get through my academic challenges, which I had particularly the first year, and I did, and I graduated, and you know, went on, became a paratrooper and a ranger in the Army, and served in Vietnam and other interesting places.
We're talking to Ambassador Jim Nicholson, who earned the Bronze Star and the Meritorious Service Medal and served for 30 years, retiring with the rank of colonel. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Ambassador James Nicholson, who from 97 through 2000 was the National Republican Chairman. And as such, you were a major force in helping George W. Bush become the 43rd president. Talk about that chapter in your life, Jim.
After I got out of the Army and went out to Denver and went to law school, I stayed in the reserve, of course, for another 22 years. But I kind of morphed into politics as getting involved in my practice of law. And I became active at the state level and then got elected Republican National Chairman from Colorado. And I was on the committee for several years and was appointed to chair several key committees, the Rules Committee and the Finance Committee. And then the race for Republican National Chairman opened up after Senator Dole was defeated by Bill Clinton in the 96 election. So I threw my hat in there, and I got elected Republican National Committee Chairman on the sixth ballot. They called me Landslide Jim and took over a party that was demoralized and depleted financially. And so once again, another one of those challenges, and it really was pretty august because people just didn't think we could win another national election. And so I set my sights on the election of 2000 to win back the White House. And we got a very good candidate nominee in George W. Bush, and we won the election, although it was delayed by 35 days, as people may remember, because of the contest in Florida over the votes, and we won it by just several hundred votes, again, edifying how important each vote is in an election. And then President-elect Bush asked me what I wanted to do, if anything, in his administration, and I said, yes, I'd like to be your ambassador to the Vatican. And he kind of looked at me quizzically, and he said, the Vatican? And I said, yes. And he said, well, I'll have to think about it. I think he had somebody else teed up for that, but he called me the next day and asked me if I still wanted to go to the Vatican, and I said, yes, I do. And I became the ambassador to the Vatican after being confirmed by the United States Senate.
That you actually went to the Vatican on September 13th, 2001, 2 days after 9/11, and you meet with Pope John Paul II at his summer palace at Castel Gandolfo. Talk about that first meeting with this future saint, please.
That was the day I presented my credentials. It was scheduled. By the way, all six of my siblings were coming to Rome, and all three of my children, and they were all traveling on 9/11, and only one of them made it. But we went ahead with the presentation because it was important that I get officially into the position. So I met with the Pope. He was still ambulatory. He and I sat down in his library at his summer palace at Castel Gandolfo, and the first thing we did was to say a prayer for the victims of 9/11, and then I was able to brief him on what we knew by then had occurred, and that these people had staged out of Afghanistan. And he said to me, Ambassador, we have to stop people in this world who are killing in the name of God. And that was an important communication because it was the Pope and all of his moral authority wading in behind our efforts to go into Afghanistan and disrupt their base. And it was very helpful in putting our coalition together in Europe particularly. He saw Iraq very differently later in 2003. He thought that was preemptive on our part and that in Afghanistan we'd been attacked. But it gave rise to a very vigorous debate that I had the challenge of over the next few years included very interesting subjects like the moral justification for war. And I got very involved in that, and I got very involved in Europe in the trafficking in persons and feeding people in Africa using new food technology, genetically modified organisms. And darned if the Pope a couple of years later didn't knight me for my humanitarian work. And so that was a wonderful honor, very humbling. But again, facing challenges as I did, particularly with the Iraq dilemma, and I always default, if that's the right word, I always resort to prayer. And it seems to have come through for me in my life just about in every challenging, sometimes very deprived, sometimes very dangerous circumstance.
Tell us about St. John Paul II, please.
He was a marvelous person. You know, the 4 years we were in Rome, we had thousands of visitors, including the president 3 times, the vice president, secretary of state, so on. And then a lot of other diplomats and friends and American citizens, and we would host. And we would get, not all of them, but several of them, you know, in to see the Pope, and they all had the same reaction, regardless of the religious stripe from which they themselves come from, and which was that they were in the presence of a very iconic person. In fact, some very good Mormon friends of ours from Denver said it was almost like he was radiating a light in the room where they met him, and That was the effect that he would have on people, and it was really interesting to observe, and it was so consistent.
Your mom taught you the power of prayer. Well, Pope John Paul was legendary for the amount of time he spent praying. When Time named him the Person of the Year at the end of 1994, part of the article, it says, "The testimony is universal that prayer, more than food or liquid, is the sustaining force of this Pope's life." Talk to us about how you saw prayer in his life.
Well, you know, for the Catholics in your audience, the Pope used to go to confession every week. And he used to hear confessions in the Basilica of St. Peter. And I would go to a noon mass there almost every day, and I would sometimes go to confession hoping that I could get lucky and have my confession heard by the Pope, because he was on a, you know, an unannounced, random basis would go into those confessionals and hear confessions. And he spoke so many different languages that he could hear most people's confessions. But he was a lot of things, but the most fundamental thing he was just a model for prayer and humility. I mean, if you think of, you know, the circumstances from whence he had come as well, living under two totalitarian governments, growing up and developing and being formed as a priest, and yet didn't have a big chip on his shoulder, had an optimistic outlook for mankind and for the world, and, you know, manifested this positive but realistic aura of the potential of people, and particularly people who could try to model their lives after his model, who was Christ, and would so eloquently talk about that in a conversational way with people of all religions, and just a truly extraordinary person, and not to mention that he was vitally important bringing down the Iron Curtain and the end of the Soviet Union.
We're talking to Ambassador James Nicholson, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with the Honorable James Nicholson, who from 2001 through 2005 served as the United States Ambassador to the Holy See, the Vatican. As you mentioned in the previous segment, Jim, one of your biggest initiatives was being a vigorous advocate on human rights issues, specifically human trafficking. Talk to us about human trafficking, if you will.
Human trafficking is a horrific phenomenon going on in the world as we speak. Most of it is controlled by organized crime, and it's the exploitation of women and in some cases young males as well for slavery and bondage. But the most horrific part of it to me is the women that are lured into the lair of these people and become sex slaves. And you could see it in Europe firsthand. And frankly, they have kind of a blasé attitude about it in Europe, thinking that it's, you know, as they used to say, it's the oldest profession. Don't get so upset about it. But I would say these are not consenting adults. These are slaves. And in Europe, most of them come from the East European countries, and they're lured there to become a waitress or an actress or, you know, some better life than they're having in their country. And they follow that lure, and then they immediately take away their passports. They try to get them addicted to drugs, and they put them out there under very tight control as sex slaves. And so we organized the first conference ever held in Europe, and we held it right there in Rome, and we had 400 people come from 39 countries and began to expose just what was going on and trying to get the home countries to establish a legal framework to prosecute these people who are part of this organized crime network. And that has matured and it has advanced, but so has the market, which is the other half of this problem, which it wouldn't exist if there wasn't a market, if there weren't customers. And they too, I think, should be prosecuted. But we made good progress, and the Pope was very supportive. In fact, he nearly came to our first conference, but did send a letter and sent his foreign minister there to read it. There is still a great deal to be done. I'm proud of my country because we lead the world. We have a office at the State Department, which is the Office of Human Trafficking. They have an ambassador-ranked director. So we're leading the way, but there's not enough awareness of it and not enough enthusiasm about, you know, enforcing laws to really have a material effect on it yet.
Getting back to the Pope John Paul, on April 2, 2005, he passed. And the unprecedented outpouring of love throughout the world upon his death was unbelievable. You were there. Talk about that week or so, Jim.
Well, it was so interesting. I was asked by President Bush to go to his funeral. I'd only been back, and I was Secretary of Veterans Affairs for only 5 weeks when he died, and the President kindly asked me to go to the funeral with him. He asked his father and President Clinton as well. And it was a different city. We'd only been gone from there for 5 weeks, but it was full of people, millions, many from Poland. And there were these lines of people to pass by, the remains of the Holy Father. And one of the things that was so interesting was that in these lines would be families with very young children. And an American woman told me this story because she was in one of those lines for 18 hours. And she said those children did not misbehave. They, for some reason, these are little normal kids. She said they were unrealistically well-behaved, waiting in this line just to walk by the remains of John Paul II to say a prayer. And then to be there with, you know, the President of the United States and two past Presidents of the United States to pay our respects and to attend the funeral mass was an extraordinary experience, but it was very, you know, spiritually wrenching, because you think of the life of this man and what we had just lost and the contributions that he had made and was leaving behind, and in the kind of life that he led. You were there for the, you know, the final celebration of the life of a truly extraordinary human being in the history of man.
Adam Cardinal Mitre soon thereafter made a statement that Pope's funeral, here was a dead man with almost no possessions, with no more power, in a simple pine box, and here you had 400 plus of the world's greatest, most powerful leaders all coming to honor him. What was that actual funeral like, Jim?
You mentioned the pine box, and you know, being there with the President of the United States, who was sitting right up in the front, and there was that simple little pine box laid there while most of the leaders of countries in the world were sitting around it during the mass, and the eyes of probably a majority of the people in the world were watching it on television as you know, the Pope to be, Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger at the time, celebrated the mass and gave the beautiful homily, and it was just stunning. It was chilling, and it was chilling to look at the rapture in the faces of all the people who, you know, were back home running their countries, some of which you know, were pretty denying of religious freedom themselves, but they were there at the Pope's funeral. And it was a most unusual world event, and one that any of us who were there will never forget.
We're talking to Ambassador James Nicholson, and from 2005 through 2007, he was Secretary of Veterans Affairs. When we come back, we'll ask him about that chapter in his life. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a modern-day Horatio Alger story, the Honorable James Nicholson, who from 2005 through 2007 was Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and as such, oversaw a network of 1,400 hospitals and clinics providing care and rehabilitation to 6 million vets. Talk about that chapter in your life, if you will, Jim.
That was another sort of serendipitous moment of my life, which has caused me to conclude in life that you know, it's important to be prepared, and when opportunity comes along, you can take advantage of it. I was actually giving a speech in Miami on trafficking in persons when I got a call from the President of the United States asking me if I would come home from Rome and be the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. And I wasn't looking for another government job, but you don't say no to the president, and especially when you have an opportunity to serve like that at a time when we had two wars going on. So I came home and became secretary of this department, which is the second largest in the U.S. government. And it, as you have said, has over 155 hospitals and 1,400 clinics, and now employs about 400,000 people. And what became clear to me was that, unlike the times before when I came home from Vietnam, I went to graduate school at Columbia University, and if I'd worn my uniform, people would have spit on me. But in the era of Iraq and Afghanistan, our citizens greatly appreciate our warriors and the people that serve over there. And so that was the good news, and they wanted the VA to do a very good job as their agent in taking care of these people, those that had been injured both physically and psychologically. So it was a tremendously challenging job, but also very rewarding, because the veterans themselves are so appreciative of the help and the service and the care that they get from the VA. And there's a lot of negative publicity about the VA, especially recently, but fundamentally the VA does a very good job of providing medical care to our veterans. And we take care of veterans in this country far better than any other country in the world. No one comes close to comparing to us. One thing I'll mention, because it reflects, again, to me, the power of prayer, is they had one employee that took a laptop and a hard drive home to work on over the weekend. It was against regulations to do that, but it had the names and Social Security numbers of 22 million veterans. That's how many veterans there are in the United States. And some knucklehead broke into his house and stole his laptop and sort of inadvertently got the hard drive that had all this information on it. And, of course, we had to let all the veterans know that their identity had been perhaps compromised. And this thing is the size of my wallet, this hard drive. But I began praying to St. Anthony, which was another thing my mother always emphasized to us. If you lose something, pray to St. Anthony, patron saint of lost items and lost causes. And I'll be darned if 5 weeks later the FBI doesn't get that hard drive back and conducted forensic tests and determined it had not been compromised. And when you think of that, how small it was and how they could have thrown it into a trash can or into the river or reproduced it, none of that happened. And it again, makes me an ardent supplicant, if not probably a nuisance sometimes, for St. Anthony to help out when I lose things. But it again underwrote in my mind just how powerful prayer is for people if you have a problem or a challenge.
Jim, what was the biggest thing our young warriors, our young veterans, taught you in your role as Secretary of Veterans Affairs?
You used to go up to Walter Reed Hospital at least every week to visit those that were up there, and then unfortunately during those times every week there were new arrivals that would come in, most of them seriously injured, almost all of them recent amputees, still kind of in shock. Their families would be in and around them, and I would introduce myself and start to get acquainted with them, and I'd plan to, you know, come and see them weekly. But I would ask them initially, I would say, you know, what can I do for you? And invariably, they would, if they could reach me, they would squeeze my arm and say, sir, can you help me get back to my unit? Which just has had an indelible impression on me of how outstanding these young volunteers are that serve us in uniform and go off to these places like Iraq and Afghanistan and endure terrible circumstances, the heat and the cold, by the way, and wear about 110 pounds of equipment and armor every day. And yet, after suffering permanent deformation of their bodies and sometimes their minds, they want to get back into serving our country and being with their unit. And it's such a reflection, I think, on the core quality and character that we still have in this country of young people.
We lose 22 veterans a day to suicide. Talk about that, Jim.
It's very unfortunate, and it's why I work so hard in trying to help veterans get jobs. I helped stand up a program at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce called Hiring Our Heroes. And the best thing that we can do for a veteran, one who's obviously not seriously injured, which most are not when they come back, but the best thing we can do is to get them back to work, get them gainfully engaged, and, you know, get back out there and having a sense of purpose and being with other people, and, of course, making a livelihood. And So we need the help of all of the people around the country, particularly employers, to be sensitive to that and to reach out to try to hire a veteran, because if they don't get a job, they can lapse back into some old habits that they had before they went into the service, or even they find some new bad habits if they're just kind of, you know, loping around too long. And so we really need to get them back to work.
As our time winds down together, Ambassador, what advice would you give our young listeners this evening?
I would give advice based on my own life, which really had some very difficult challenges, and that advice would be to pray, to persist, prepare, and be patient.
Do you ever pinch yourself looking back at your life, Jim?
I often do, because when you go through something where, you know, where you're hungry on a sustained basis for days, and you see no way out of this, and then, you know, fast forward to where you are at the moment, and the experiences that you've had, it is definitely a pinch me experience, but it also causes me to realize just what one can do in our country if you do, I think, follow these principles of. For me, the number one is being prayerful, and then persistent, and then, you know, work hard and be prepared. So if opportunity intersects with your path, you can take advantage of it. That's not at the exclusion of you know, having fun and having a sense of humor. There are a lot of reasons to do that as well, and have friends, but. This is a fantastic country that we've been blessed to live in. And, of course, another part of my current prayer is that we can maintain this country as we've known it, because we have some challenges, I think, in doing that.
Ambassador James Nicholson, what a shining example of a life of service. Thanks for all you've done. Thanks for all you continue to do. God bless.
Thank you very much, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahn.